Before we get started, today's episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Are you happy because you win, or do you win because you're happy? At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. Stay tuned for the Ultra Player of the Week coming up later in the episode. All right, welcome on to Hollinger and Duncan special late night edition. Thanks so much for joining us on Locker Room. And John and I have a little bit of a potpourri that we wanted to get to. We're going to get to your questions even a little bit earlier than we normally would, but I think where we wanted to start is in talking about the ever-present buyout market. And with Blake Griffin and LaMarcus Aldridge now in Brooklyn, there's a lot of carping. There was a anonymous quote from small market executive in Howard Beck's column this week complaining again about the buyout process and how that disadvantages small market teams. So, John, you were a small market executive with the Memphis Grizzlies. What is your reaction? Just let's talk generally about the buyout process before we get into some of these specific contributors on the buyout market.
Yeah, so the basic idea is that a player who has money left on his deal, it's almost always an expiring contract, will give back some of that money so he can sign someplace else instead. And so in theory, it's a win-win because the team that grants the buyout gets savings and they open a roster spot for a player they maybe didn't really want around anyway. And then the player himself gets a win because he goes to a situation that he thinks is better for himself. So that's sort of where it came about. The tricky part comes up, I think, when it seems like all the players want to go to the same two markets, right? So, does it give New York and LA even another unfair advantage just in terms of basically this is a second free agent period almost, even if it's for not great players, where they clearly have an upper hand in a lot of these situations, and guys aren't necessarily flocking to, Milwaukee or Memphis. I mean, we had a good team in Memphis. I don't think we signed one buyout guy the whole time we were there. We actually claimed Beno Udrih off waivers because we didn't want to get into the buyout game with him because we weren't sure we would win. And that was probably the one sort of equivalent guy like that we picked up in 2014. And he really helped us in that playoff series against Oklahoma City where Nick Calathes was suspended. So thank God we did that. But, we were fortunate because Beno had a minimum salary. Most of the guys who were buyout guys aren't in that situation. And so it's not plausible to do a waiver claim or whatever, or even trade for him in some cases. So the question is, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about what this does in terms of leveling the playing field or unleveling the playing field and whether this is something that we should want to continue. And so, I actually don't know what your thoughts are on this. So I'm interested to hear them.
Well, longtime listeners of this program and other programs of mine will know that I do find some of the complaining by small markets to be a little bit, if not overblown. I mean, obviously there are certain markets where free agents generally would want to go and certain markets where free agents generally don't want to go. But beyond that, and just in terms of like the financial resources as well. But it's funny that you mentioned the Milwaukee Bucks because the Milwaukee Bucks have actually now signed more buyout guys, I think it was since like 2015 or 2016, than any other team in that period. And they've been good and they've generally have not had the deepest teams in the world. So I do think that there's a component where playing time and trying to establish a market is a big part of it. And we could talk more. I mean, the biggest argument, I think, against this being a big deal is there's a reason that these guys aren't staying with their current teams because those teams aren't trying to compete and they're going to a youth movement and the player doesn't want to be there anymore. And generally, the team doesn't want them to be there anymore as well. I mean, can you think of any of these buyouts where the team really like would have wanted to have them? And what happened in Beck's column was this GM was complaining, and this is actually a new complaint on this issue, was, well, hey, if you want, this agent will say, hey, if you want anybody of my guys to want to come to your team, you got to play ball with my client on the buyout market. But do these teams ever like really want to keep the guy? Can you think of any examples of that?
I can't think of a situation where that happened. And, usually usually you're in communication with the player's agent by that point, certainly, where it's like, no, we don't, because the trade deadline comes first. So you're saying, no, we don't intend to trade you, and we don't intend to trade you because we plan on keeping you. And in teams where that's not the case, it's pretty clearly the opposite, that yes, we are calling teams about trades for you because we know that you're a free agent after the season and our season is going off the rails. And so why wouldn't we take calls on you? So that's a new one where it's like something that agents demand now just for whatever guy. I've never seen that as a thing. And it's almost foolish for an agent to go down that road. Like, if the team wants to keep your guy, so that's a team that's willing to pay bird rights money to keep your guy, you're going to be like, no, buy me out so I can, you know, so I can just take exception money this summer. Like, that's bad agenting.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there is a little bit of a component here of teams complaining, well, hey, we can't get a second round pick for this guy now.
Now, that to me,
everyone knows he's going to get bought.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that to me is the more legitimate issue with the buyout market, that it not only prevents the teams with the guy from getting a second round pick from him, but it prevents other teams from doing the same. In other words, like my last year in Memphis, we had Garrett Temple and Jamichael Green on expiring contracts. We couldn't get a draft pick for either player because teams were saying, well, we'll just wait for Wes Matthews or Wayne Ellington to get bought out and sign them for free. So why would we give you a draft pick? And so that actually is real. I mean, the cost of it is like, okay, we're talking about, you know, realistically, we're talking about, you know, second round pick from a contending team. You're talking about like, oh, I missed out on the 53rd pick in the draft. Like, it's not this isn't throwing competitive balance out of whack. But at the margins, I can see where a rebuilding team, the buyout market does hurt them a little bit because it creates an alternative market.
Well, one of those things actually, I think, played out in a very lurid fashion, if you're a member of the New Orleans Pelicans front office today, with J.J. Redick's comments on his podcast. And for those who didn't see that yet, J.J. basically accused the New Orleans Pelicans, David Griffin and Trajan Langdon, of misrepresenting what they said they were going to do. He asked for a trade because of COVID. He wanted to go back to the Northeast in November. And supposedly, according to JJ, the Pelicans haven't responded yet. That's important to say. David Griffin said, hey, report down to New Orleans and we'll accommodate you within a month. They never did. Then supposedly, according to JJ, when a trade to his preferred destination in the Northeast near his family didn't materialize, the Pelicans said they were going to buy him out. But instead, they end up getting a second round pick from the Dallas Mavericks to send JJ there, where, and he was clear that because of COVID, that wasn't really what he wanted to do. Now, he also is getting paid $13 million, and the uniform player contract says that your rights could be assigned to another team in a trade. And JJ also said he went to New Orleans to play with Jrue Holiday, and he knew he wasn't going to play at all under Stan Van Gundy because without the defensive versatility of Holiday, that meant that Stan Van Gundy was going to want better defenders on the floor instead of him, and he couldn't play with Holiday anymore because the Pels were in a rebuilding mode, which they hadn't been when he signed there. And so, you know, a lot of he said in this case to that. But now, obviously, JJ Redick, very respected player, his agents, the Pels have quite clearly angered them.
Yeah, so you don't know what went on behind the scenes. Obviously, you want to have as open and honest a dialogue with your player as you can, especially regarding a situation like this. What I don't know is if he was willing to walk away from the deal in order to not be in New Orleans this year, and basically just like, I haven't heard the interview. So, you know, was he just sort of lured into showing up because they thought they'd accommodate him quickly enough? So that wouldn't be great if that was the case. But
I did not get the impression that he was willing to leave his $13 million salary on the table. That certainly was not said in the interview.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are very few players that can say, you know, A, I want to be traded, and B, I want to be traded to this particular destination or subset of destinations. So, I mean, when they were able to get a second for him rather than buy him out, yeah, I mean, that's what you do. That's how a front office works. I'd say the greater issue is, I mean, they sat him out for a few games, you know, where it looked like they maybe were going to have a deal, and for whatever reason, nothing happened. So, I mean, that's the one where you could probably ask a little more questions and say, what was going on right there that they thought they were close and probably led the player to believe they were close, and then everything fell through.
March Madness has returned, and Paramount Plus has the games you won't want to miss. Watch CBS games live on Paramount Plus, including the Final Four and the National Championship game on April 5th. Paramount Plus is also the home to year-round sports, including the Masters, PGA Championship, UEFA, Champions League, and Europa League, the NFL, and more. Plus, you get breaking news, experts' picks, highlights from all your favorite teams with CBS Sports HQ, a 24/7 sports news network. The Masters is a tradition unlike any other, as they like to say on CBS, and Paramount Plus is the place to watch it. Visit ParamountPlus.com before March 31st to receive a one-month free trial of Paramount Plus. That's a good time to sign up for it when you get the NCAA and you can get the Masters in the next month. That's ParamountPlus.com to receive a one-month free trial of Paramount Plus. That's ParamountPlus.com. Hey, you guys don't need us to tell you about Locker Room, because you can see the benefits of it just by listening to this podcast. The Locker Room is the first social audio platform made for sports fans. You can download the app free once you're in. Talk with me, other fans, athletes, and insiders. Even host your own room with your favorite team or your favorite sport. So go download the free Locker Room app right now, currently available on all iOS devices. Be sure to create a profile, link your Twitter, and join the NBA group for the latest league updates, or you can join NFL, MLB, or NHL if you're into that as well. And you can follow me, of course, at Nate Duncan NBA. Follow John at John Hollinger. My partner Danny LaRue is on there all the time as well. John and I are usually on some point on Wednesdays, usually 2 Eastern and 11 Pacific. Sometimes we have to change up that scheduling, but that's the time to join us on Locker Room every week. Yeah, I really have no idea what ended up happening there, obviously. So that's a part of this. But the other part of it, too, I still think this big small market thing is being overplayed. I mean, ultimately, these guys aren't that good. We'll talk more about that. But for example, like Wes Matthews, when you were talking about him, he signs in Indiana. And he signed in Indiana partially because they could offer him more money and partially because they could offer him a starting role on a playoff team. Yeah. I guarantee you that that small market executive who is complaining doesn't work for the San Antonio Spurs this year. Buyout market was pretty darn good to them.
Yeah, it amounted to a positive trade for them, right? I mean, LaMarcus left a huge amount of money on the table. Although in fairness, they had given him that huge pile of money in the first place by needlessly guaranteeing his contract. So maybe he was more willing to give some of it back, or they had, I don't know. But going from LaMarcus to Gorgui Dieng, I think was a clear upgrade for them and how they want to play.
Well, and they're able to pocket a bunch of money from him. They pocket a bunch of money from the Warriors to take on Marquese Chris and waive him because LaMarcus gave that money back, so they could stay out of the tax and yep. take on Chris. And they, as you said, probably upgrade at least for what they need with Gorgui Dieng. So I think this really, it all gets back to this issue of just what the names are of these players. And Blake Griffin, LaMarcus Aldridge, I mean, is this, we kind of saw the same thing with the Warriors when DeMarcus Cousins was coming off the torn Achilles and he signed there and everyone was going crazy about the competitive balance. It turns out DeMarcus Cousins didn't end up helping them too much
in the end. Nor the Lakers a year later. Yeah.
So what do you make of LaMarcus now in Brooklyn?
Well, as you point out, most of these guys are bought out because they don't really have value anymore in the trade market. And so we're talking about guys who, especially in the context of like winning a championship, are very fringe guys who honestly probably won't be on the floor in situations that matter. We had one buyout guy who ended up mattering somewhat last year with Markieff Morris. But that was an odd one because he was on a bad team and not even playing well. Like there was not a bidding war over Markieff Morris's services, right?
And he gave up, didn't he give up a second year as well to get out of his contract?
Did he give up?
I think memory serves that he had, I want to say he had a player
that option he had a player option that he gave up. You're correct. It wasn't for a lot. It was for like $3 million or something. So it wasn't for a lot of money, but he had a player option that he gave up. And he ended up, he ended up losing on that, I guess, because he's on a 1-year minimum now. So, he got to the situation he wanted, got a championship.
But so ultimately, if these guys were any good, they wouldn't be getting bought out in the end. The New Orleans Pelicans probably would have bought out J.J. Redick if they couldn't find a trade for him. He wasn't even playing. Stan Van Gundy had him out of the rotation despite his supposed fondness for J.J. Also, I thought it was very odd that the the Pels didn't just try to trade him right away in the offseason. You know, the reporting around it at the time was, oh, they really value him in Stan Van Gundy's system, and like he's going to be such a mentor for the young players and blah, blah. And you know,
I mean, it seemed obvious that it was going to, that it was going to come to this, right? That they were going to have to trade him at some point because they weren't winning the championship this year. And so moving him out and getting some value for him was the obvious move. The one thing that might have held me back, I mean, coming in this year, you just looked at that team and were like, oh, there is no shooting at all. So if you're going to turn around and trade Redick too, that might be the one thing that would have held me back.
So is LaMarcus going to help the Nets?
It might actually be subtraction by addition. I wrote about this for The Athletic this week, especially if he if he steals minutes from Claxton, who I think is the guy who can really be that sort of switchable five, who can rim run a little. Like if when they want to play big, I think he's their best big option. But now you have DeAndre who started tonight, right? And you have Blake Griffin and you have LaMarcus, and they're all guys with status in the league, who are, you know, gonna command minutes probably. And especially in a situation like LaMarcus, where actually multiple teams were trying to get him, and you have to recruit a little bit and you're all offering a minimum salary, there probably were some promises made about playing time to get him there. And same thing with Andre Drummond in LA. And you wonder about what harm those promises might inflict.
This is also, I agree with you there. I think Claxton, clearly their best defensive lineups are probably going to have him on the floor at this point. And maybe you can argue with LaMarcus that with his pick and pop game, or if he's going to spread the floor from three, matching up against Joel Embiid specifically, that it'll be a little bit harder to guard. But, you know, you got Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant and James Harden already. And maybe also the idea is that if you can't switch LaMarcus because like he'll go and post you up, but I still like the front end of that switch.
If you want to post up LaMarcus, like, be my guest.
Yeah. Well, you probably even are lower on what LaMarcus has been these last couple of years than I am. And hey, if you can manage the situation, he gave up a lot of money to get out of there. And there's talk that Miami might be the favorite for him, whether that deal was done before he gave that up or not. I think a lot of times probably teams and sources go out of their way to make it sound like there is some bidding war for the player's services, just so it doesn't look like there's collusion before the guy actually got bought out. Just people covering their tracks.
Yeah, totally. Because
if the league is going to, like, for example, the Bogdanovich situation, the only way the league's ever going to know about this stuff and investigate it is if there's reporting that it's a done deal too early. And so as long as you can just kind of obfuscate that and make it sound, oh, it's a real horse race. He's a free agent. He's so great that he's a free agent now. He can start evaluating his options. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Right. sure thing there.
But, it's like it's like the movie Draft Day, but for free agents, right? Oh, hey, the draft's today. I wonder who should I pick?
Yes. Well, did David Kahn star in that movie?
Yes, probably.
So it would seem he gave up all this money. He's going there. It seems like there have been some assurances made. But also these players, LaMarcus and Andre Drummond, they're players of stature. They probably assume that anyone in their right mind is going to play them. Maybe they don't feel like they need an assurance. But sure, it's great to have another guy there who might be able to contribute. He's an NBA level of big man. Still, there weren't a ton of those available. They needed more size. Maybe he can hold up okay against Embiid in the post. I don't really think so. He's never really been like a legendary post defender or anything like that.
Yeah.
So if you can handle it right, sure, by all means. I mean, this is also, I think, you know, Rich Kleiman and KD, maybe this is more of a them move, which they've had some success. The Harden thing's looking pretty good so far. We'll see. Well, John, that certainly is a lot of discussion about one player, LaMarcus Aldridge. So much discussion, in fact, that we'd be remiss if we did not make LaMarcus Aldridge the Michelob Ultra Player of the Week. It's only worth it if you enjoy it. Will Nets fans enjoy LaMarcus Aldridge? LaMarcus Aldridge certainly thought he would enjoy being in Brooklyn with 2.6 carbs and 95 calories. You're always going to enjoy Michelob Ultra. Joy creates success. Enjoyment isn't the end game. It's the whole game. Are you happy because you win? Or do you win because you're happy? Michelob Ultra. LaMarcus Aldridge, the Michelob Ultra Ultra Player of the Week. I'm really excited to tell you about a new podcast I think you're going to like called Death at the Wing. It's a sports documentary podcast hosted by Adam McKay, the writer and director of The Big Short, Vice, and Anchorman. The 1980s saw basketball players like Magic Johnson and Dr. J, Michael Jordan become household names. But along the way to wealth and stardom, the excess of the 80s took its toll on that next generation of basketball, and we haven't seen in the history of any sport so many who are ready to become stars face tragic deaths in such a short time frame. Adam McKay is joined by sports journalists and experts who lived through these moments in history to explore this overlooked phenomenon and the web of social, political, and cultural forces at play. Search for Death at the Wing wherever you get your podcast to start listening. What about Drummond into LA? That's the other big acquisition. He's signing for the minimum as well as LaMarcus is. What do you think he's going to be able to give them?
Well, he's a plus seven in 7 minutes so far, so I think it's really working out.
Who are they playing tonight?
They're playing Milwaukee right now.
Oh, Milwaukee. That's a real team.
Yeah. No, they're actually winning in the first quarter. I don't love the fit there, but I think he actually can help in the short term while Anthony Davis is out. Just because, like, they need something, and he can give them some offensive punch. They're a bad shooting team, and he's an awesome offensive rebounder, right? So, like, his main skill is actually more useful on a team that can't shoot. So he'll help there. He can definitely do some stuff like around the elbows. He's not a bad passer, and maybe make life a little easier for some of these other guys. So I can talk myself into the Drummond one a little more easily, even though I think once it gets down to brass tacks in the playoffs, he probably doesn't play a minute.
Yeah, I brass tacks being like, okay, it's a 2-2 series, and
like, yeah. The games where you're really like, okay, we have to have our best players on the floor because this is a good team that can beat us. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he gets that Dwight Howard, the Keith Bogan start the first 6 minutes of the game.
That could definitely be a thing. Yes. First 6 minutes of each half, and then it's either Gasol or Davis or Harrell or even Markieff Morris. I mean, they actually have a lot of options at the five now when they're healthy.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we'll see. I mean, maybe I think the reporting was supposedly that Drummond's ability to take on a large role and compete immediately would help. And we've seen guys, he still has the skill set. I think these last couple of years, particularly in Cleveland this year, he's probably been given a little bit too much rope by J.B. Bickerstaff. He and JaVale have had some...
JaVale's off on another planet, but yeah, Drummond's had some pretty interesting offensive possessions in Cleveland as well.
Don't talk about Denver that way. I mean, that maybe given some of the things that are legal there, it would make sense. But it's legal in New York now, too. I guess we can't make those jokes anymore about Colorado.
It's spreading, yeah.
So in any event, I'll be interested to see what happens with Drummond. And maybe with the LeBron there, a more focused role, he could be better. But yeah, it's just the post-ups, not really great finishing those offensive rebounds. Like he shoots, you know, like 55% at the rim or something, just incredibly bad for a center. And the Lakers don't have a ton of spacing. I don't see this one shifting the championship. Certainly. No. Again, he's kind of another body. I'm interested to see, I guess Marcus Ole is just going to not play now. Is that the plan?
I can't talk about this rationally.
Well, unless they go up against the Nuggets, and then I think Jokic
or Embiid, you definitely want Mark out there, I think. Against these other teams, though, I don't know how much we're going to see him just because offensively he hasn't given them a lot of punch this year. Unfortunately.
And there's actually also, as much as you might be complaining about the buyout market, we haven't heard anything yet on Avery Bradley. There's a talk that he might get bought out, but OKC kind of doesn't like to do that. He has that team option for next year.
Yeah.
If you're OKC, you don't have anything else to do with that. Maybe you opt him in.
Houston, right? He's in Houston.
Oh, geez. Is he in Houston?
Yeah.
I
only retained that because I was just looking at their box score.
Well, maybe Houston tries to do, they got plenty of, same thing about OKC, yeah.
I'm surprised Kelly Olynyk hasn't gotten a buyout. And I think he'd be a really good target for Boston, certainly.
That's a good one, too. And because Olynyk is just a straight expiring contract. And you have no idea what the plan is right now in Houston. I mean, the plan has to be get into the top three. Like, they have to be in the top three. Otherwise, that's negligence with their pick.
Yeah.
But, Raphael Stone was talking about, oh, we're not tanking. We don't want to be bad still. I'd do the James Harden trade a bunch bunch of times in a row, even though they took the package that would enable them to tank then, but he's denying that. So who knows? I mean, but Bradley, you know, you could opt him into that team option next year if you want to, and then maybe you can do the old Sam Presti, get something for him coming and get something for him going in the offseason if a team would give up like a second to get Bradley in the offseason instead of just buying him out. But maybe they're just negotiating what the price is going to be for his freedom as well. That could be another aspect. Otto Porter is another one in Orlando. Yeah. People thought he would get bought out. It doesn't look like it's trending that way right now.
Orlando may have some use for his bird rights.
Yeah.
So I could see them not doing that. I mean, on two levels. One, they might be able to work something in a sign and trade that's advantageous. Two, like re-signing him isn't a terrible option. Even with them rebuilding, you can do sort of what the Knicks did with Marcus Morris, you sign the guy and then if he plays well, you can trade him at midseason. But like they have to sign somebody to play small forward next year. So like having Otto on that roster, he's not even that old. Like I don't think that's necessarily the worst thing for them to re-sign him.
No, they're not going to have cap space. So I think that actually makes some sense to try to bring him back. As you mentioned, they don't really have anyone to play small forward. He's a better shooter than anyone else. They'll probably pay him more than anyone else. I mean, you know, maybe it's kind of one of these like $10 million second year team option.
Yeah, exactly.
Type
yeah.
of things, or maybe a non-guarantee that vests based on playing time, so something along those lines would make some sense. So yeah, Mike Muscala in OKC, Colin Reed mentioned it in the comments here,
yeah.
as well as another one. Again, it just seems like now, and his contract actually expires, so there's really no reason to keep him around. He's not even playing.
He's not playing, frankly. Yeah. They've kept him out and Horford. So I don't understand why Muscala wouldn't be a buyout unless his agent hasn't found a landing spot for him. I mean, that would be the only reason not to do it at this point.
While I have you here, by the way, what do you think of this Horford thing that he's just going to not play the rest of the year?
I mean, we we at least suited up Mark for the games. I mean, shit. like this is brazen, right?
It's pretty brazen. Is there a solution to it?
Ultimately, I mean, the solution, I think the league came up with the best solution they could in terms of flattening out the lottery odds in order to reduce some of the incentives to do stuff like this. Like, it's still going to happen, but you can argue in OKC's case that like, okay, this guy's going to be on our roster next year. He's old. We just don't want to risk injuring him in games that don't matter. So you could argue, because that was one of the things I brought up from our perspective with what we were doing with Mark at the end of that season. Was it 2018? We basically capped his minutes because we said, look, he's had a, you know, he's X many years old. I forget how old he was at the time, but it began with a three. He's had a navicular injury in his foot, and like we're supposed to play him 40 minutes in games that don't matter just to make other people happy. Like we wanted to make sure that he would get through the season and be part of our team the next year when we were actually like trying to win. So even if we didn't have a draft pick at all that year, we would have had an incentive to pull back on his playing time.
Right. That's exactly correct. I've made that argument as well. And particularly with OKC, where they have young beings. Moses Brown, you wrote about him this week. He's been unbelievable on a per minute basis. They want to see what they have with him. And I think they also said they want to work to get Horford somewhere else this offseason. And so preserving him. And also, I think maybe even a small part of this is that Al Horford would rather have it be known that he's missing games because they're shutting him down rather than that he's missing games because he's injured. Because that's the other thing, is like if the league wants to say, hey, like you can't do this, Thunder, they could just say, well, Al Horford has had
back spasms,
tendonitis.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm sure he has. Like every NBA player is 34 years old. You could find something for him.
I don't know if you remember back in the day, there was actually an injured list in the NBA where they would basically list players on the quote unquote injured list with bullshit injuries, just so they would, you know, because you could only have so many players active and so many players in the injured list.
Right.
So they basically just stash bodies on the injured list with the two favorites were back spasms and tendonitis.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Knee soreness. Jeff Stotts and I actually talked about that on the pod a couple of weeks ago. He was talking about how that screws up his database from before, whatever it was, like 04 when they actually got rid of that. So there's no way around this ultimately. And I agree with you that even if there weren't draft pick incentive involved, it would still make sense to do exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's what else I want to talk about here. Danny and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, but I wanted to get your thoughts to just take stock of where the league is now. The buyout market is done, the trade deadline is done, and we analyzed all those moves separately, but where did they put these teams in the league hierarchy? So wanted to talk about this. Well, we can use this as a way maybe to transition into some comments and questions as well. If you guys want to start getting those speaker requests in now for Locker Room, we'll probably get to those maybe in about 10 minutes or so after this segment is over. But let's just talk about it. Has anything changed for you based on the trade deadline and the buyout market as far as who the favorites are? I mean, you and I haven't even talked about that, I guess, since the start of the season. So I don't even know who your favorites were and who they are now that all this stuff is in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. So I thought the two contenders that helped themselves were Denver and Philadelphia. And of the two, I would say Denver helped themselves the most.
Yeah, it's early, but that net rating for that starting lineup with Aaron Gordon is completely off the charts. Again, a couple of games only, but yeah, that does have potentially, and he's probably the best player that moved to a team that realistically could be in championship contention. Maybe Victor Oladipo would be the other one if he can come through. But as far as just their stature in the league and the price paid to get him too, the price paid to get Aaron Gordon was the highest, and I think that's commensurate with his value.
Yeah. And then I think George Hill is going to help the Sixers, but his impact isn't on the level of Gordon's, but it fixes a weakness where when Philly went to the backcourt off their bench, they had a lot of not great options they were cycling through, and he's going to take over those sort of Korkmaz, Maxi, whatever minutes and make them much more solid.
Yeah, absolutely. And he can even replace maybe Shake Milton. He could play with Shake Milton. He could maybe replace Seth Curry if they need more defense. So all three of those guards really can take all of the minutes now. And I think all of those guys provide different options. So who is your favorite in the East right now to come out and actually represent the conference in the NBA Finals?
I think it's probably got to be Brooklyn at this point. Even though I have questions about them too, I mean, they just have so much high-end talent. They've played pretty well since the trade, even with really not having their full lineup much. And Milwaukee has been up and down. I mean, I think Philadelphia is a wild card just because Embiid might just murder the Nets so badly that they can't make up for it with their own offense, right? So that's the one that's really interesting. I think Embiid gives Philadelphia a puncher's chance against these other teams, even if they might have less overall talent, maybe.
Yeah.
But I think at this point you have to put Brooklyn in the driver's seat. It's a three team race. Would you agree with me on that?
I would. Maybe the Celtics or the Heat could get into it. I would give the Heat a better chance of that than the Celtics right now. But we have seen those teams play at a high level. But, those were the two conference finalists last year. They have most of the same cast of characters back. So I wouldn't rule out that it would be possible for those teams to get in there. And the Heat, for example, we've seen they have a matchup advantage over, say, the Bucks. I'd be very interested to see what happens with that series again. But obviously, the way they've played this year, you'd have to say those are the top three. To me, I have the Sixers the lowest out of that group in terms of their playoff viability. Embiid's, what he's done in the clutch this year has been pretty good, but I still worry about his health as well, in addition to the Nets guy's health. And I think the Bucks are just a little bit more dynamic and versatile than the Sixers are, particularly defensively. I worry about the Sixers' versatility defensively, particularly going against the Nets, but also maybe even the Bucks to some degree as well. And I do think that the PJ Tucker acquisition for the Bucks, we didn't talk about that as much because it happened a little bit before the trade deadline and some other moves happened afterwards. But I don't know that PJ Tucker is going to be a panacea, and maybe he's just too old and he'll be injured. But I think there's a chance that he could really revolutionize what this Bucks team is doing defensively.
It definitely gives him another option in the playoffs if he has anything left in the tank. I'm with you. Like, it may just turn out that he's completely washed and doesn't help. But I thought it was a pretty decent risk all told for the Bucks. I mean, basically an eight spot or so move in the draft backward to get him, and they move off of Augustine's money next year. So I thought that was a reasonable acquisition to give them some variability in how they can play.
Yeah. DJ Augustin, he plays for the Rockets, right?
Maybe.
Or he's on the Rockets.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
So, and I also really like PJ Tucker because I think he actually is going to be, if I look up and down every roster in the Eastern Conference, he might be the guy I would most want to guard Joel Embiid.
Interesting.
He gets low on guys. He's always guarded Anthony Davis real well. I know those aren't, he and Embiid are not the same type of players, but PJ Tucker gets low. Like, you are not going to move PJ Tucker, and he's smart. He's not going to fall for, like, kind of the foul drawing tricks. I do think Joel's face-up game might be pretty good against PJ. Like, if he can just shoot right over him, and that's, like, if you look at the stats when Joel just faces up and doesn't dribble and just shoots that jumper, that's it's pretty good. But, you know, PJ can kind of get into his body a little bit, maybe move his feet a little bit better. And I think PJ also does a pretty good job on Kevin Durant historically as well. Same thing, being able to kind of get underneath him a little bit. And all right, caveat that PJ could just be done, but I really like that matchup. I would say I would pick the Nets to beat the Bucks if fully healthy, and I would pick the Bucks to beat the Sixers, Nets to beat the Sixers as well. But I think Nets Bucks could actually has the potential of being a classic series.
Yeah, what I love about where we are right now is that I don't feel like I have a great deal of certainty on this. In other words, I could see either of these three teams coming out of the East, and I could see multiple teams coming out of the West. So that's fun to me, right? To not know.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that just overall these playoffs, you look at both the East and the West, if everyone's healthy, I think it's going to be like a really, really good playoffs. And now that's probably asking too much, honestly, with this wacky season and how much of a slog it's going to be the rest of the way and the crazy schedules that some of these teams have played and are going to be playing. But if we could get relative health from all these teams, I think it could look really, really good.
We could have an awesome second round in particular.
Well, football may be over, but the NBA, college basketball, and the NHL are in full swing. I like it better when football is over, personally. And BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your sports action. In fact, BetOnline even covers awards, TV shows, and reality TV. You got real-time updated odds and props on almost anything that you can imagine. BetOnline has you covered for all the news, scores, and odds. It's the best way to place your bets, and it's free to sign up. Head to their website or use your mobile device to sign up today and receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. That's pretty good. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts, and don't forget the promo code LOCKEDON to let them know that you came from us. RockAuto.com is a family business. They've been serving auto parts customers online for 20 years now. If you're into working on your own car and truck, saving some money both in labor and on parts, go to RockAuto.com and you can shop for auto and body parts from hundreds of manufacturers. Just put in the make and model of your car. It's everything from engine control modules to brake parts to tail lamp, motor oil, even new carpet. Their catalog is really easy to navigate, and the prices are always reliably low, and the same for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. There's no reason to go to the auto parts store in person, especially these days, just to find out that they don't have your part and they're going to order it online the same way that you could with rockauto.com for a less expensive price and without going to the store. So go to rockauto.com right now, see all the parts available for your car and truck, right locked on in there. How did you hear about us box, so they know that we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. rockauto.com. How about the West?
Yeah, you know, you could argue that Utah was the big winner at the trade deadline because nobody else in the West other than Denver made a move that really vaulted themselves forward, and so that increases Utah's odds of prevailing.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Nobody, unless you want to say the Nuggets, that would be, but I'm not sure that Aaron Gordon replacing Gary Harris does a ton for the Nuggets versus the Jazz specifically. I think he does more for them against the Clippers and the Lakers.
Yeah.
And maybe the Suns as well. He probably is a pretty decent matchup against Devin Booker. But in the West, so much of it is just going to come down to seeding, and holy crap, is it going to be hilarious watching these teams in the upper half of the bracket try to avoid the Lakers in the first round.
Yeah, that's going to get really interesting if the Lakers end up falling to six, especially. And, you know, what do the Clippers do in that situation? Do they try to knock themselves down to four and get out of the Lakers bracket?
I went through it really. I think the Jazz looking pretty good to be number one. They have the easiest schedule the rest of the way. Like, their 538 projects them to finish six games ahead of the Suns. I think the Clips are going to kind of start taking it a little bit easier. They lost it home to the Magic. Paul George is being out of the lineup. Beverly, Serge Ibaka. They got guys that they're just... I know they would love to play everyone and get into a rhythm, but that's just doesn't seem like the health gods are ever going to cooperate for that team. I think they're going to fall down to four. And the reason they're going to fall down to four is I don't see the Lakers staying in five. We'll see. I think we'll have a pretty good idea, actually, after the next 2 weeks of whether the Lakers are going to be five or whether they'll be six or even potentially seven. I actually think if I had to pick where I think they'll be, I think they'll be seven.
Wow. You know, some of that's going to depend on Portland and Dallas here, too.
Sure. Right. Yeah, that's and those teams have their own injury issues as well. But I think the Lakers are really going to struggle. We'll see. Maybe they'll do better. AD will come back earlier. LeBron will come back earlier. But it seems like they're going to really be prioritizing health. So the Lakers, to me, if they had their whole team, we knew everybody was going to be healthy, I probably would pick them. But man, are they going to have a tough run. I mean, they're going to have to play, you know, this is going to be a Houston Rockets 1995 style of gauntlet.
Exactly. Through. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's they and the in the 16 team playoff era, I think they and the 99 Knicks, I think are those the only ones to make the finals seeded sixth or below, if memory serves. Hopefully the comments could certainly let me know if I'm forgetting anyone on that one. But
I think that's correct. And the Rockets beat, I want to say they beat a 3, a 2, a 1 and another one. They beat like 4 60 win teams or something. It was insane.
Yeah. Yeah, they beat the Jazz, the Suns, and the Spurs. And then, the Magic only won, I think, like 57 wins and were one of like the greatest offenses of all time. They swept them in the finals. That's a pretty good Rockets team. Rob McIntyre makes an interesting point here in the comments that wouldn't you want to play the Lakers early when health for them will likely be at its worst?
Yeah, I think I would.
And particularly if they're coming out of the play-in already. If you're the Lakers, would the play-in scare you at all? Would that be a big priority? Like, hey, we can't fall into the play-in?
Oh, I think it has to be, like, just because it's too easy to just fluke your way into either missing the playoffs or ending up in the eighth spot. Like it's because it just comes down to one game then. So I think you want to avoid that.
Yeah, I think it also just depends who is looking like they're going to be the 3 seed, who's going to look like they're going to be the 2 seed. I'm pretty sure the Lakers would rather play the Suns than the Clippers. Let's say you're the Lakers, you know that the Suns are going to be 2 and you know that the Clippers are going to be 3. Now are you less scared of getting in the play-in, or are you still just like, hey, we got to get in, let's play the Clippers in the first round?
I feel like you're going to play either Clippers then Suns or Suns then Clippers, right? So is it that big a difference?
Yeah, maybe not, or maybe there's a feeling though that they need to get their sea legs under them. Mm-hmm. I guess my thought would kind of be, if you can't win one out of two games against, they probably would rather play the Jazz than the Clippers, I would bet too, even if they fell to the 8. At least I would personally. You might feel differently because I know you're a little more of a Jazz stan this year than I am.
Yes.
But if you can't win 2 games against the 8th seed and the winner of the 9th and the 10th seed, you can't win one of those 2 games, you probably weren't going to go too far against a good team anyway, would kind of be my thought.
Most likely, but I'd still want to avoid it.
Yeah. I mean, fluky shit can happen, I guess. And also, if both those games are going to be at home as well, it's,
What if LeBron turns his ankle in the first quarter of the first play-in game?
Yeah. No, that's true. I just have no idea what AD and LeBron are going to be in the playoffs. I mean, that's the biggest question mark to me of just about anything. And KD, obviously, on the East side as well. I think he's got a better chance he's coming back early. It seems like they've just been incredibly conservative with him, whereas these LeBron and AD, I mean, those are some real injuries. So, yeah. All right, give me your pick to get out of the West and your champion as of right now, and then we'll get into the speaker requests here.
I'm riding the Mike Conley gets his ring bandwagon.
Wow. So not only do you have the Jazz coming out of the West, you have them winning the championship.
Yeah.
Wow.
They've been the best team in the league by far all year. So I'm riding with that.
Yeah, I just don't see how they could beat Brooklyn in the end, because I think Brooklyn switching can slow the Jazz down just enough.
That I mean, What does Utah do against switching defense? I think you've nailed the question that will determine whether what I said actually happens. Yeah. Well, what can they do against switching defense? Can they maintain that ping, 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 or does it just degenerate into Mitchell taking 20-foot pull-ups?
And not only that, I think that Utah's defense, Brooklyn, is probably the worst matchup for Utah's style of defense because they don't need to get all the way to the rim. They have a ton of three-point shooters. You can make Rudy Gobert guard a three-point shooter, and they don't have the individual defenders to prevent KD or Kyrie from getting any type of a look that they want to on a jumper off the dribble if they're feeling like they don't want to challenge Rudy Gobert. So either the driving kick game of Harden or KD and Kyrie in the mid-range, I mean, Utah just doesn't have the defenders to deal with that,
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, so that Brooklyn matchup is the trickiest, without a doubt. I think Milwaukee, they probably would feel pretty good about. You know, you can put Rudy on Giannis, yeah, and you know, even Philly, they probably feel okay about.
But I would be remiss, though, that you picked Brooklyn to come out of the East, and you're picking the Jazz to come out of the West, but you are picking the Jazz to beat them then in the finals?
So here's the thing. If I knew it was Brooklyn against Utah, I'd probably be more inclined to pick Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But, I guess I'm looking at the entire of the field and kind of what are the odds of things happening along the way. It's definitely tough. I still like Utah's total odds package, I guess, better than anyone else's. But I'll take the field over Utah any day, right? Like, there's eight teams that can win this.
No, and in the West, definitely, I think so. I actually have the Clippers versus Nets would be my pick, and I think I would pick
the Nets
to win it.
I can't quit the Clippers either. I'm with you on that. I just think they have a lot of different ways they can play against people. They have Kawhi and Paul George as the shot creators. They've got some other pieces that maybe haven't played as well this year that are capable of more. So I still think they're really tough. And I'd probably put them 2A and Lakers 2B.
Yeah. Their clutch struggles do leave a little bit to be desired. But 41.5% from three as a team doesn't leave too much to be desired.
Not at all.
and I like the Clippers matchup against the Jazz as well. Okay, let's jump in here to the speaker request. Thanks for everyone who wanted to get in. Let's go with AGNBA. You are on right now here on Locker Room with me and John.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and feel free, guys, but since we're recording this as a pod, just start talking, and if we don't respond, you can assume that we don't hear you. But yeah, what do you got for us, AG?
Okay, yeah. My question was, do you guys think there's any chance that a perimeter defender could deservingly win Defensive Player of the Year in today's NBA?
Ooh, that's a good question. Is that inspired by Ben Simmons, AG? It's some of the noise coming out of Philly lately?
Yeah, that hype train. And if the answer is yes, who would be like your prime candidate for that?
Well, I don't think the answer is anybody this year, because Rudy Gobert is certainly going to win, I would think. But, I think there are other guys that have come close and had a case. I mean, certainly we had Tony Allen in Memphis who had a great case. And I think did he come second to Mark the year Mark won it, or third, or anyway?
I'm not sure. Yeah, that was 2013. I can't remember that. So here, I'll give you this, John, as a context. The only two perimeter defenders to win Defensive Player of the Year this century were Ron Artest in 2004 and Kawhi back-to-back in 15 and 16. Those are the only ones to win it. I would say, at least as far like actually winning it with the voters, I think that's possible. Being my pick to win it, I would be, particularly in the regular season, because I think those type of players are actually more valuable in the playoffs, particularly in the regular season, I would say it would be a hell of a long shot.
And we're saying Giannis is a front court player for this discussion.
Yeah. He's a four. You know, I mean, like, his rim protection was, and help defense was the number one skill. I mean, you got Giannis and Draymond as fours, and then everyone else is a center who's one at the center.
The thing that makes it so hard for a perimeter defender to win something like this is that you can negate one-on-one perimeter defense a lot of times just with screening and with switching, especially since so many teams switch now. You know, it's funny that Tony just hated switching and would just like basically try to run through every screen so we wouldn't have to switch. We could stay with the guy. But the way the league is now, I just think it's so switch heavy that single like shutdown corner type of defender probably doesn't matter as much as he used to.
Yeah, it's particularly with now the proliferation of smaller players screening. Those guys are so small, and then they're such good shooters popping out to the perimeter. They're so fast to get separation from the point of the screen and get out there. You know, think of a JJ Redick type setting that screen, for example. It's just so difficult to stay with your guy in all of those circumstances. And then obviously those guys don't do as much as help defenders either. And so many people like to point to like Draymond Green. You know, Draymond Green is a unique defensive force with his ability to help and his ability to switch and his ability to guard guys one-on-one and to guard guys that in the post as an awesome post defender with his strong base as well. I don't think we're going to even see, you know, maybe you could say that that's a perimeter defender. I don't really see it though. I mean, is there anyone that comes to mind for you, AG, as far as someone that you think should be in there?
Not particularly, but I just think one year they'll just give it to Ben Simmons, because I feel like perimeter defense is more appeasing to the eye than like help defense to the casual fan.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think that's helped Marcus Smart in the voting a bit too.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, AG. That's a good question. I don't think so, particularly in the regular season. I think it's because the big can be involved in just about every play as a help defender, where it's just it's so hard to do that as a perimeter guy. Let's get to Rob. Good to have you back, Rob. How you doing?
Hey, I was just curious for that last question. What would PJ Tucker be considered in that context?
I think you have to think of him as a big, don't you think, John?
Yeah, I mean, they played him at his most valuable position defensively a lot of times is a five, right? So he's more of that than he is like the one-on-one perimeter stopper, right? Like, you're not like, oh yeah, we're going to put him on James Harden and that'll take care of things.
Yeah.
No, but they would use him on like a wing score, which is why I was curious. But anyways, so I hear a lot of people talk about the Lakers eventually just going and playing three shooters and LeBron and AD together once they're all healthy. What actually is like the lineup they can get you that you're comfortable closing a playoff series with them?
Well, they would need to find one shooter before they could get to three, right? That's probably the biggest thing holding them back. I think it's probably something like Schroeder, KCP, and Kuzma.
Okay. I guess Kuzma's the third shooter there.
Caruso
would be in that mix too.
Yeah. Also not really a shooter. Yeah. Caruso is having really a down year. When you're talking about his offensive production, I think there's some hope that Wes Matthews could be that guy, but he hasn't been quite at that level. He was supposed to start for them, and then that ended up not happening. Talen Horton-Tucker maybe gets in that mix if he's playing well, but one thing I will say is I thought that Frank Vogel, at least last year, did a really nice job of finding the combinations that would work at the end of games in the playoffs. And they're a good crunch time team in the playoffs last year. And he was able to cobble together enough with some hot hands. That was helped by the emergence of playoff Rondo, who they're not going to have this year. So I think they just got to kind of do it by committee. And maybe there'll be some teams where they go with Harrell or Drummond as well, potentially. Or maybe it'd even be Marc Gasol if they're going against Jokic. So they do have a lot of looks, but you're right, Rob. I mean, the one that they don't really have is really good shooting around the AD LeBron pick and roll, which is probably what you would most want to have. That's like the most logical way to build the team in the end. Thanks for that, Rob. Let's get to Jonah Willard.
Hey, you guys. Thanks for letting me on. I'm a huge fan, and that's why I hate to have to kind of push back against.
Let's do it, man. That's what we are here for. That's what locker room is all about.
Against the notion that the Nuggets were a big winner at the trade deadline. I'll ask you to recall that the Nuggets, they were really getting burnt by Donovan Mitchell in the first five games of that series last year before the newest member of the Magicians Alliance, Gary Harris, came back and was really able to bail them out of that series. And with Harris gone, they don't really have a great option. Like, I mean, I know that Campazzo fans exist, but I don't think he's going to be some panacea that can stop like an elite point of attack guy. So I guess my point sort of is like, can you appease those concerns? Because there are a lot of great guards in the West. And if I'm a guy like CJ McCollum, even, I'm just kind of looking at that Nuggets defense like it's lunchtime, you know? And keep in mind, the Nuggets defense, it's actually slipped a few spots from from where it was last year. So I guess, like, I know if they play one of the LA teams, then sure, yeah, you're very, very happy to have Gordon on board. But I actually worry that trade's going to hurt them more against several Western Conference teams.
Yeah, I mean, against like a real guard, you're asking Barton or Campazzo, or, you know, you want to shoehorn Gary Clark into that role. Like, I don't really think
what about Gordon? You think he could do it?
I mean, is he really the guy to be like chasing around smalls like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, he has looked a little bit slow moving his feet this year. I will give you that.
Yeah. This is one of the reasons that, like, I think this trade actually sets up the Nuggets to peak next year, because they'll have the offseason to add one more guy. Like, they can trade Barton and their draft pick, or they can trade, you know, some other, scrape together some contracts and get kind of that one more guy. Because I think they need another guard. They need somebody to be what they thought Gary Harris would be, and put that guy out there with Jamal Murray, Jokic, Gordon, and Porter next year, and you have an awesome team. I think as much as the trade helps them this year, I think next year is when you see peak Nuggets.
So a couple of responses to what you're saying, and we noted that when we were talking about them matching up specifically with the Jets. So you're not, you're pushing back on us in some ways, but in other ways, I think we're in agreement. First of all, they make up for that with offense. Aaron Gordon is just a much better offensive player than Gary Harris. Having Aaron Gordon out there enables them to also play Michael Porter Jr. and not worry about his position defensively as much. You're taking Paul Millsap off the floor, who's really a negative offensive player at this point in time. So that rolling to the basket that Gordon has as a cutter, he's an underrated passer. He's probably at this point maybe even a better spot up shooter if you need him to do that than Gary Harris is. He's good getting out in transition, can do a little post up as well. So I think they get better offensively. So that's one way. And then the other thing I would say is, I think the Nuggets believe that PJ Dozier can take on that Gary Harris role if you really need him to. They are very high on his defense. He might be even worse offensively than Harris was, because Harris would at least shoot the three, which Dozier is kind of off and on with his willingness to even do that. What do you think of Dozier, John?
Yeah, I mean, he's shown flashes, certainly, and we just need to see them more consistently. And then at the offensive end, you're right. I mean, the shooting has always been a weakness of his, going back to college even. And even, you know, Harris, I think opponents still treat as a threat, and Dozier, I think they won't even guard.
Yeah. So any reaction to that, Jonah?
Yeah. So I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying. I hate to like try to pin you down to a prediction or anything, but I've specifically been thinking about that matchup against the Portland Trailblazers. Cause what, and to be fair, full disclosure, I am a Blazer fan, and what my Blazers have been doing recently is they've replaced Derek Jones Jr. with Norman Powell in the starting lineup. And I mean, I have mixed feelings about that, but that's another story. But anyway, I think that the Blazers could get away with that against Denver, just because the Nuggets, they don't really have that wing score that would really force the Blazers to put out like a bigger lineup. And I just feel like a Lillard, McCollum, Powell lineup, like, I just think that could cause some pretty serious damage against the Nuggets defense. I wonder what your guys' take on that would be.
Denver would have to play pretty well the rest of the way to get to a first round matchup with Portland, right? They basically would have to move up to three.
Portland could get to five. Yeah, Portland could get to five, I think.
Like a 4-5. I guess. Yeah, you're right. Okay.
I do think Gordon, I think he might be okay on CJ, because CJ's not like incredibly fast. You know, he kind of, I think he actually does better against guys where he's got a little bit of a size advantage on him. So I mean, I'm not saying that I know this or not. Gordon, we'll see what he can do. They made a big bet on Gordon, and I'm not sure how good he is, but I think he might be able to do okay on CJ. Then of course you got the Dame problem as well, but they'll probably just have to bring Jokic up and trap. And they'll probably do that with CJ as well. And so
how much was Harris helping them when the last time they played Portland was death by CJ McCollum?
Yeah, no, I think that's, but CJ, he'll just go into the straight great ISO game, doesn't even need a screen, maybe more than Dame. And so maybe that's where the question comes in. But yeah, great question there. And I think none of us really know the answer to that one. We got time maybe for two more here. Let's get to Justin Bautista. Justin, you are in.
Hey, so this question is about Potfo, or Popovich in the front office. To Spurs fans, they've developed this reputation of taking care of their own, but perhaps being too nice, you know, really player-friendly contracts for higher character guys. So Patty Mills, 4 for 50, Pau Gasol, 3 for 48, Aldridge, 3 for 72. But these really hampered their flexibility at the time. And no, nice guys finished last, and that might be bad GMing, but LaMarcus Aldridge gave back $5.8 million in his buyout, which might be the first tangible payoff they've received from their, you know, quote-unquote goodwill. So is there truth to this reputation of their front office being too nice and taking care of their own? And if so, does it pay real dividends long term, you know, for non-glamour markets like the Spurs?
I don't think they've been too nice. Like, they're not handing out bad contracts like Halloween candy the way some other front officers certainly have done. That Gasol contract wasn't good, but if you recall, that was the summer of love. What year was that? I mean, that was the year
2016.
We gave Parsons $94 million.
Yeah, and, I would understand if you've chosen to forget what year that was.
Yeah. So I mean, relative to that, I mean, Gasol getting the contract he did at that time wasn't necessarily the worst thing that could have happened. The guaranteeing Aldridge's deal was a little weird, but they also got some of that money back. I don't think anyone thought the extension he signed was a bad one at the time it was signed. And the Mills deal, I mean, I was actually surprised they didn't trade him. I thought Patty had trade value at that number.
Yeah, he's kind of waxed and waned a little bit, Mills. I think there was a thought that he'd gotten overpaid, but summer of 2017, he might have had offers right in that range. And that's one where, like, overpaying by, you know, a million or two for a guy, and Patty to me has been one of the best reserves in the league since he signed that deal. So he's annually one of the best plus minus guys off the bench. So that's not too bad. Overpaying by a million or two, that's one thing. If it's okay, we're going to bring you in Pau Gasol or LaMarcus Aldridge for more guaranteed years at, like, you know, $20 million a year or $16 million a year, that's where it starts. I think you can start to go off the rails a little bit. But you also say, you know, what ended up being the opportunity cost for them doing that in the end. And maybe you could say that Pau Gasol signing him originally, that was really more what I had a concern with then. And I think what they did in 2017 was they got him to opt out, and they were going to try and get Chris Paul. And then when he didn't come, it was sort of like, all right, if we don't get Chris Paul, Powell, now that you've opted out, because he had a player option for like $15 million. Now that you've opted out, we're going to take care of you, Powell, because we don't really have anything else. I don't know. I mean, what do you think about that, Justin?
Yeah, that I'm remembering that. Yeah, that Powell one, that felt like a wink-wink deal where it was like, okay, if we get Chris Paul, you sign a one-year deal, and then we re-sign you for more money with your bird rights. If we don't get Chris Paul, we'll let you opt into the money that you were going to get it anyway on a new contract. So I think that's what happened.
Yeah. And also, Justin, I would say they didn't, I don't think they overpaid on DeJounte Murray. Would you agree with that?
Oh, no. At 4 for $64, most Spurs fans think that's a pretty great deal.
Yeah. And Danny Green, they got him on a pretty good deal in that summer of 2015 as well. 4 for $40 was pretty good. So, I have my issues with the way that the Spurs front office has operated. I don't think they've had a lot of creativity in terms of transactions, but I probably in the end was a little bit more critical of them for some of that stuff that you're talking about than they ultimately deserve. So thanks for that question, Justin. And let's get to one more here, and that's going to be Russ Heltman. Russ, you are on. Russ is not on. Okay, let's try Andrew. Sorry about that, Russ.
Hi, I'm really happy to be talking to you guys. I love your podcast. My question is about the Cleveland Cavaliers. I'm a huge Cavs fan, and I'm really starting to like the pieces that they're putting together in their young core. So my question for you guys is, how do you evaluate their young core? What do you think of the pieces that they're putting together so far? And what do you think that they need to do to take it to the next level?
Well, you know, who is the guy who's going to be the best player on a good team, or even the second best player on a good team? I mean, maybe Sexton can get there. I mean, he could definitely score. The rest of his game is right now is pretty much negative, but you know, he's young enough to still get a lot better. So there's that. Jared Allen, I think he has a little more room now to explore like what he's actually going to be as a starting center. I mean, I definitely like that move for where they are in their timeline. They should be able to retain him. He's probably the second kind of big piece. These other guys, you know, Garland or Coro, I think they're pretty big question marks right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Who are you really excited about? Andrew, do you think that John is missing the boat on some of these guys? But yeah, who do you, to just to answer the question that John put rhetorically, who do you see as, you know, being really good pieces on, you know, a perennial playoff type of team on this roster right now?
I really like Jared Allen. He's been great for the development of the guards, especially considering coming from Andre Drummond, having him roll to the hoop and being a nice lob threat, and also on the defensive end, him being a protector for two undersized guards. I really like him a lot. I've really been impressed with Darius Garland about his playmaking ability. He had a shot that was through, like an assist through his legs the other night. Just made everybody just go, oh, that's incredible. Colin Sexton, I was a big fan of his. I still like his scoring game. I think he needs to up his playmaking a little bit. And Okoro, it's kind of a coin flip at this point. I don't think we've seen enough of him so far.
Yeah, I do like what we've seen from Okoro defensively, for sure. And I think Colin Sexton continues to take steps forward each year. He has dropped off since that 10-11 start that the Cavs had. He's down to 37% for three. And I think that's kind of more what he's going to be than a guy who's bombing, you know, eight threes a game at 40%. And that's realistically, if he's going to get to an all-star type level, I think that's kind of where he needs to be. And I know he's talked to the media about needing to shoot more threes. And so if he realizes that's a priority, maybe he can get there. But you got to be happy with Garland getting up to 40% from three and getting a little better on the rim, a little better with playmaking. But he also, you know, doesn't have the type of volume. I do wonder, too, whether JB Bickerstaff is, from an offensive philosophy standpoint, is the guy that I want maximizing 2 3-point happy guards necessarily. So I worry a little bit about that. But I think if they could get if they get Cade Cunningham in the draft, then I think a lot of these other pieces kind of slot into where they need to be. But they still need that number one piece where you're just like, yeah, this guy's a future All-NBA player. I can't say that I see that on the Cavs roster right now. What about you, John?
No, I don't either. I'll add, I like Dylan Windler as like a role player, you know, third forward type of guy. I think he's got a good chance to be a plus reserve.
All right. Thanks for that question, Andrew. And thanks to all of you for joining us here on Locker Room. We'll be back at the normal time next week. Actually, we may not. We'll stay tuned on exactly when we're going to be back next week.
One quick update, Nate.
Oh, yeah.
Andre Drummond is now a -4. So my position is completely changed on him.
Yeah. Well, you have to be willing to update your priors, John.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, so happy last day of March to all of you. And we love this community. This is just like a great online space. All of these questions, the agreement or disagreement is really respectful. We love talking to y'all. And let's do it again next week. We'll talk to you then.